Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the electronic Charles.
Wow. Well, you know, my good friend, spring is here. It is officially upon us. And you know how I know that?
How?
I'm drinking iced coffee with my breakfast.
Are the geese flying north as well?
Geese are definitely flying. I hear them every day. And but this iced coffee, being a transplanted New Englander, a real Southerner and a transplanted New Englander, I have to have iced coffee frequently, you know. So I'm having iced coffee with my breakfast this morning.
When I taught in Binghamton, I would have my office in the seventh floor of this huge, ugly tower that was on the Binghamton campus. It was ugly.
I remember it. Yes,
But I had a big panoramic view out the back of the office building, and I would wait in the fall. Huge flocks of snow geese, different ducks would come flying over this mountain, and then in the spring I would see them going north again. You know, I love that part of being there because the campus was right at the bend in the Susquehanna River, which you could tell these geese navigated off of that somehow. They would turn at that bend and they'd come right over the campus. Huge flocks of them too.
Yeah, that's great. Somehow it just reminded me that your description of Binghamton was where the Appalachians meet the Rust Belt.
Yeah, basically where Appalachia meets the Rust Belt. Look, there were lots of fantastic people I met there, but it was a poor rural area with a dying mill town in the middle of it. And of course, that created a lot of poverty and a lot of sadness. And as I said, a lot of great people too.
There's a lot of places like that in the Northeast, but having visited you in Binghamton many times, there is a special sort of feeling like that there. But there were nice people there, as you say.
Yeah, it's where two bands of poverty met.
Hey, I look at it this way. Your living there got me fishing the Delaware River. So I will for always be thankful that I had you to visit there and got me interested in the Delaware.
The East and the West Branch.
Exactly. So what are you having for breakfast this morning?
I am having a classical McConville. Mm-hmm. Four strips of bacon.
Okay.
The garlic bagel with Irish butter.
Goes without saying.
Some delicious red table grapes.
With the red grapes. That just, that's so not a breakfast food. But okay, all right.
Some delicious fresh squeezed orange juice.
All right. Yeah, good. That's a good addition. I'm going to do something very special for breakfast this morning in honor of spring. Something I've never done on the Historians before. I'm going to have duck eggs.
Wow.
Yep, duck eggs. I'm going to have two duck eggs over easy on my hash. Doesn't that sound good?
Well, as you know, I don't eat any eggs, so I don't know.
Duck eggs. Maybe you would like duck eggs. Have you ever thought about that?
No, I've never thought of them, nor do I want them.
Well, it's just so close-minded of you. I don't understand. You've never.
I'm anti-egg eating. I'm anti-egg eating.
All right. Well, listener, don't worry. we won't go on and on about eggs and his miso-oval. ways. Miso-ovarian. I'm not sure. Miso-ovarian. I'm not sure what the actual term would be for egg hater. But anyway, so we're going to give our listener a break today from the troubles in Northern Ireland. What episode were we up to? We've done five, haven't we?
We're up to episode five, and we were up to the hunger strikes. We decided to break here and do the news.
Yeah, the World History Update episode as a break from Northern Ireland. We're not even going to mention Ireland today after, I don't think.
No, probably not unless we get to it in this week in historical news. So we're not going to have an episode on it.
Apart from the Kerrygold Irish butter, this may be an Ireland-free episode.
Yes.
Historians. Well, with you here, though, it's hard to be Ireland-free. That's
right.
There's always a little Ireland on the Historians, always. All right, World History Update, and where are we going first, Professor Brendan McConville?
We are going to East Africa.
All right, East Africa.
For another installment of East African Update.
It's become a hot area of interest for the Historians.
Yes, and I would also say the Historians were at the cutting edge of all news services in America in terms of the issues there.
As always, head of the curve.
I will say this, and I hardly ever make this kind of editorial or however you want to make it pronouncement. We better start paying attention to what's going on in Ethiopia and in Eastern Africa. there's been, as some of you know, there's been fighting in the north of Ethiopia along the Eritrean border in the area known as Tigray. There have been reports, repeated reports, of the massacre of civilians, ethnic cleansing, and the use of sexual violence as part of that war.
Oh, gosh.
The Tigrayans were resistant to control the central. In other words, there's been a tendency in Ethiopian politics that want to create a stronger central government. It's a federated region and has many different linguistic and ethnic groups in it. Ethiopia, of course, it's a former empire. The people in Tigray did not want to be controlled. They particularly didn't want their election moved. They held an election in themselves. It led to armed conflict. They were overrun by a combination of Ethiopian and Eritrean troops. The Eritreans acting in alliance with the central government. As I said, there's been repeated stories about massacres there, the use of sexual assault in this and ethnic cleansing. Now what's happened is a guerrilla war has broken out. The Tigrayans are experienced in guerrilla warfare. They were leaders in the guerrilla warfare against the Dirge, which was the Marxist dictatorship that deposed Haile Selassie and had seized power in Ethiopia for a significant period of time. They helped overthrow them. There is apparently guerrilla fighting.
Would it be fair to call this a separatist movement?
It is now.
Okay.
It is now. I don't know if it started out that way, but it is now. This is a piece from the Financial Times. This is a headline from somebody in a Tigrayan. Ethiopia will be digging up mass graves for a decade. Inside wow. Tigray's dirty war. That's the title of the article. It's a dirty war in the north of Ethiopia along as the Eritrean border.
Do I remember from a previous update that the Tigrayans had actually been in control of the Ethiopian government at one point?
They were the leader of the coalition that displaced the Dirge, and that coalition held power. I believe that was in the early 1990s, and it held power until 2012 when the leader of that, who was a Tigrayan of that coalition, died. And it led to a period of kind of turmoil. And now the person who's running Ethiopia is from the Oromo group, which is a different group in Ethiopia. They're the largest single group in Ethiopia, although they're not the majority. And the Tigrayans, of course, that caused conflict when they lost that leadership role. That definitely is part of what has happened if we situate it in a sort of deep, in its deep context. The central government wants a more integrated Ethiopia. And of course, when I said that at the beginning, when I said that we need to pay more attention, Ethiopia is the second biggest economy in Africa and the first leading manufacturing economy, I think, in Africa. So they're bigger than Nigeria. The only country that has a bigger economy is South Africa, and its industrial orientation is towards extraction. In other words, mining and sort of related industries related to mining. So Ethiopia is extremely important.
Is there any sign of non-African powers interesting themselves in this conflict and or getting involved?
The United States tried to intervene in this in the sense of trying to urge the different parties to what was going on in Tigray to go to a ceasefire, but that failed. It's unclear to me whether the Chinese, who have very significant influence in Ethiopia and in East Africa generally, what their level of conversation about this is or how they're involved. They may be involved, they may not be involved. I don't know. I would not be surprised if they were involved, but quietly behind the scenes, which is more their style in East Africa. So yeah, it's an extremely serious situation. Along with that, a guerrilla movement has broken out. A guerrilla fighting has broken out in Oromia. In other words, the area dominated by the Oromo ethnic group. Why? Because that ethnic group does not want a stronger. They want the federated Ethiopia to continue. They don't want centralization. It's not dissimilar in some respects. This is a gross generalization. It's central power versus local power, or federation versus central power. That's the conflict. While that's been going on, though, there have been several incidents and pretty serious incidents involving Oromo people involved in guerrilla activity against the central government or the central government's perceived allies in the area. There has been violence along that line.
So this is a multilateral situation. It's not a bilateral situation.
No, it's a multilateral situation.
Okay.
There are other groups that do not want that central government. As I said in this, our original East African update, Ethiopia has over 50 linguistic ethnic groups within it. thinking about it in terms of American racial terms does not help us understand the Horn of Africa. It's an incredibly complex society. It is a changing society.
Religiously, too.
Religiously, too. We're going to talk about that in 1 second, but it's incredibly complex because even in terms of religion, you have evangelical Christians, you have Orthodox Christians, and you have Muslims. And so you've got, and you have people
and who Jews.
Practice... And Jews and people practice traditional African religion. So you've got a very complex situation. There's also now been conflict, including some sort of armed pushing and shoving along the Ethiopian and Sudanese border between Sudan and Ethiopia, which is a colonial boundary, goes back to the British Empire in Africa in the 19th century. I looked more into that because I was curious as to what the origins of their conflict was. Of course, there are several possibilities, but part of it is that boundary goes to an area that's a kind of fertile bottom land that's well watered. So in other words, it's a potentially strong food producing region.
Right.
Both countries want it. That also though is tied to the issue of water and the dam in Ethiopia. That issue has not gone away, and the talks between the Ethiopians, the people of Sudan, and the Egyptians have collapsed again. And that issue is extremely dangerous. The Egyptians are saying that you know basically putting a red line, saying if we're not getting the water we want, it may lead to a military conflict.
Because we're talking about a dam on the Upper Nile.
A dam on the Upper Nile that would restrict the water supply of the countries downstream right. from it, including Sudan and Egypt. Pardon me. Right. Yeah. So that has created, the Ethiopians do not want to concede anything because not only do they have a growing population, but because the country is so dynamic economically, they're looking for power. In other words, to be able to generate electricity, that dam would provide electricity between 30% and 40% of the Ethiopian population, which would allow them to then wire the country for internet, that portion's. Right. So naturally, it's a huge issue. Yep. That issue is not going away. As I said, Ethiopia is the second largest economy in Africa. It's the first largest, I think, manufacturing. In other words, with an industrial base, a lot of that has been funded by China. I would also note about Africa and East Africa, unlike Europe and North America, its population, in fact, this is true throughout Africa, continues to grow. So they've got a growing population, which creates a different demographic dynamic and a different set of imperatives for the country. So you've got a local versus central conflict within Ethiopia. You've got conflicts with the powers around it over water, and you've got a conflict with Sudan over the border because of fertility, fertile land, which of course these issues have traditionally, it's unsurprising that these issues cause conflict. That conflict, I think, is a very important one going forward. And I think we need a sort of deeper awareness in America about what's going on in East Africa, both in terms of their relationship to East Asia, particularly China, their relationship with each other, that those things have become far more important in the last 10 years than perhaps they were in an earlier period.
Well, you remember how long those mass killings went on in Rwanda before people actually paid attention. And you just hope we're not getting back to a similar situation here.
I would also note, because we're coming up on our first break, but I would also note that there's also been increased tension between Islamic populations and Christian populations in a number of countries. And there's recently been a massacre in a town in Mozambique, including beheadings of people by Islamic militants. There was an excellent piece in The Economist. I have it here. If I can find it. There's some suggestion that the turmoil in the Arabian Peninsula, particularly in Yemen, is spilling into East Africa, which, of course, there's close connections between East Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, which, again, as Americans, we're not as aware of that as perhaps we should be, in that there's connections, and when there's turmoil in the Arabian Peninsula or in East Africa, it will wash, to the other area. There's definitely some conflict in Yemen. There's also, and that's mainly a Shia versus Sunni conflict, although there's other aspects to that conflict, but there's also Islamic radicalism in the Sunni population, and that is flowing into East Africa, and it's leading to conflicts in all the countries down basically to the border of Zimbabwe, far south. We are coming up on our first break. We'll be right back with the historians.
Hi, this is Mike D'Estacio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550. And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com. You can climb a mountain.
When you're working, the hours can be really early, causing drowsiness that inhibits productivity. That's why I like to start every morning with a cup of joe by New England Coffee. New England Coffee is made from only the finest coffee beans from Africa, Central, and South America. New England Coffee offers tons of different options, covering all over the light to dark roast spectrum, so you can find that perfect sweet spot for your coffee cravings. Next time you need a wake me up, choose New England Coffee. Available at supermarkets, restaurants, and institutional dining areas near you.
All right, we're back with the historians. We just had an East African update. Brendan, you just mentioned Yemen and the western part of the Arabian Peninsula. It reminds me that we should do a show or maybe multiple shows on the origin and early history of Islam, which is something I think that many Americans know almost nothing about. And just the difference between Shia and Sunni Islam alone is very important. And it's not that hard to understand. We should do an episode on that.
I would really be thrilled if we could do that. I think it would be fantastic. And I would also note that there were Jewish kingdoms at the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula, and that part of the Ethiopian Jewish population, which there is a Jewish population in Ethiopia, some of them were airlifted to Israel throughout the late 20th century and early 21st century, but that there were Jewish kingdoms there, and they came into conflict with the early Islamic movement. And it's just a fascinating region with a complex history. And the
Romans really were quite interested in it and tried to establish a province there under Augustus, if I remember correctly.
But failed in doing so, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
We're now turning to our East Asian update as part of our continuing, journey around the globe. And having made my pronunciation of, pronouncement about pronunciation. Yeah.
Are you going to prophesy again?
Yes, I have something to say.
Oracle.
We need to pay attention to what's going on with Taiwan and its relationship to China. We need to pay attention. Mm. That may be headed towards a crisis, one which is going to be very uncomfortable for us, I think, and for the American people and for the United States government. It's an extremely difficult situation.
Well, some world officials need to actually learn to say the word Taiwan, because some of them won't do it.
Right. Well, they're afraid that this will lead to a conflict with China, which is just, it's not helping to solve anything to talk that way.
Avoiding reality.
Avoiding reality.
Taiwan does exist, whatever you think about it or whether you recognize it diplomatically or not. It's there.
We've discussed Taiwan before. And of course, to give you just a really brief background, Taiwan is, of course, an island off the coast of China. It has an indigenous population, which is, as I noted before, they're related genetically to the people of the Polynesian and other peoples of Oceania in the Pacific. Taiwan has never been ruled by the People's Republic, and it has not been under Chinese control, even nominally, which never was strongly, but was part of China, but has not been under even nominal Chinese control since the late 19th century, since the Sino-Japanese War of 1895. In earlier times, it had also been, there were trading posts of the Portuguese Empire there, and then they were supplanted by the Dutch, and there was a power struggle between the Portuguese, the Dutch, and the Emperor of China over control of Taiwan. It has a very complicated history. In 1949, the remnants of the nationalist movement in China fled to Taiwan, and a large influx of people from mainland China, Han-speaking people from mainland China, went into Taiwan. That's just to give you a background, yep. and it has never been under the control of the People's Republic again. So,
but they claim it.
They claim it as part of historic China, which they have a strong claim. I mean,
have used their influence to try to prevent other nations from recognizing Taiwan as an independent state.
I believe at this juncture, only 16 countries around the world still have embassies in Taiwan, but their relationship with the United States is relatively strong compared to these other countries. That's a remnant of the Cold War period. It's a remnant of what happened in the Korean War, which is another thing we should do some shows on, the Korean War. But I do think that what's happening in Taiwan now is that President Xi of China is increasing the pressure on Taiwan politically. And there is a lot of military posturing around Taiwan. And I think that it's a really serious, serious issue, because I think that he sees that, President Xi, as being part of a kind of his signature thing, which is, I reunified China, as with Hong Kong, and did away with all the imperial past where imperial powers preyed on China, and I've made China strong again.
Brendan, is there any parallel here between the Putin government's move to capture part of Ukraine and open up their warm water port on in the Black Sea? Is this just an ideological move by China, or is there a strategic value to Taiwan?
There is strategic value. Also, Taiwan is a major manufacturing center. It's a major financial center in East Asia. It has an extremely successful economy. It is part of China's effort to project its power out into the, you know, into the sea, as it were, mm-hmm. South China Sea, East China Sea. It also is an issue of national pride in terms of that we are able to dispense with the sort of the imperialist past where we were preyed upon. I think there's a number of issues at work. It's more than one. And not only that, but it's a unifying thing. In other words, we're struggling to get Taiwan back in the fold, which is part of our destiny. And this is what makes China strong and great, reflects our strength and greatness. And right. Therefore, that creates national unity and national identity. And it subdues criticism of the party, because you can always say, well, the party is leading this struggle to do this.
Yeah.
So you have to think about it that way. Chinese aircraft from the People's Republic have repeatedly challenged the Taiwanese air defense zone. They're the sole Chinese aircraft carrier. They're also building some more aircraft carriers, is patrolling right near Taiwan. There's an American carrier group in the area. I would also note that the Chinese Coast Guard, as we talked about in an earlier episode, has new rules of engagement, as do the Japanese Coast Guard. The American Coast Guard is operating in East Asia. So you can see there's a very serious danger there, in my opinion. I don't think we should underestimate that could become a kinetic war. In other words, a shooting war. It is entirely possible, unlikely, but entirely possible.
Are you raising it above the Kashmir zone as a likely hotspot at this point, or a more likely hotspot?
In this moment, but not sort of long term, but in this moment, yes. I would also note that a lot of this is playing against the dynamic in the internal politics of Taiwan, where you have some people who don't want to declare independence and sort of remain sort of this notion of we're part of China somehow, even though we reject the People's Republic, the Chinese Communist Party. And those, many of whom are younger people who have no memory of what happened in the Chinese Civil War and the flight to Taiwan and the building up of Taiwan. Those people, some of them want independence. And of course, the Chinese government has declared repeatedly, if Taiwan declares independence, there'll be a military confrontation. And now that today, the leaders of Taiwan issued a declaration saying, if China invades Taiwan, we're going to make them pay. In other words, we're going to use what weapons we have. The United States has been selling weapons again to Taiwan. And of course, you can see there's a logic in that to America, because if you get some drones or some sophisticated missiles and they fire them at the Chinese Navy, the idea that you could really hurt China, even though you obviously might not defeat China, which seems improbable that Taiwan could fight them off, there's an advantage to that. One of the other things that's going on that sort of parallels this is there's a movement in Hong Kong, which has now basically been completely, is being absorbed directly into the mainland of China. The whole idea of one country, two systems has collapsed. The history classes in Hong Kong are being taken over in history, which I think I mentioned in an earlier show. History is being rewritten in Taiwan so that, Hong Kong, pardon me, its history is being rewritten to make it parallel that of the history of the People's Republic.
Right. I'm gonna object to the use of the word collapse of the one country, two systems. It didn't collapse internally. It was pushed over.
It was pushed over, right. Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, it was pushed over. There has also been two other movements in China related to the writing and the teaching of history, which I think are significant. President Xi, of course, his father was a leading official in the first generation of Chinese leaders. He's restoring many of the historical sites associated with Maoism and sort of hardcore Maoism, and sort of trying to integrate that history, because he fears, as we've talked about in earlier East Asian updates, he fears criticism from those who would say we're no longer purely Maoist. So he's trying to integrate that history into a comprehensive history of China, which somehow leads from the Red Guards to Red Capitalism, so to speak.
Yeah, I love this. This is two things I love. One is the idea of hardcore Maoism.
Right.
So those softcore versions out there. But it's also the idea that, you know, they have changed their approach economically, but they're trying to cover their tracks ideologically, as it were, and say, no, we're still hardcore Maoists.
Right.
So we're obviously not.
He realizes that where they are now is not compatible with the historical origins of the Chinese Communist Party or the People's Republic. And therefore, he's trying to integrate them to create what I would call a historically cogent or historically coherent timeline. And that is, of course, a huge project. One of the other things he's doing is, and of course, I assume this comes from the top, he's acutely interested, President Xi, in history and how it's used politically, is that he's trying to integrate some aspects of the history of the nationalists in China, the people who fled to Taiwan, into Chinese history to create a coherent whole, particularly in their resistance to the Japanese during World War II, in which they played a much more significant part than American scholars allowed for many years, because American scholars were under the influence of left-leaning scholarship.
Well, there's so many contradictions here and so many problems, but you know, one thing is, if you're trying to argue historically for one China, you have to accept the fact that one China came about through imperialism. And it wasn't communist imperialism. It was good old-fashioned pre-communist imperialism.
Right.
So that's a historical issue they have to deal with. But it's interesting, isn't it, to note that there is a kind of convergence going on in the world economically, where this marriage of state, state controlled is too strong a word, but state involved, state adjacent capitalism is in fact becoming the route that the West and the East seem to be embracing.
Right. I agree completely. And this leads to this another issue, which is that the Chinese government has now created and normalized a digital currency in the hope of undermining ultimately the US dollar as a reserve currency. And if we keep printing money at the level we do, the dollar is going to lose, countries around the world are going to lose confidence in the dollar as the reserve currency. I don't think they want to turn to China, because I think there's a lack of trust there on a fundamental level. But the dollar's centrality, which in some respects is more important to American power than any nuclear submarine, than any kind of nuclear.
No doubt. Absolutely.
The dollar centrality to the world's economy is under assault from three forces: China, Russia, and private creators of Bitcoin and these other digital currencies.
Four forces. The fourth force is the American government.
Government
has devalued the dollar consistently for decades.
I agree. It has devalued the dollar. Yep. The creation of this digital currency, part of it is it's their way of trying to give a lifeline to themselves and others who might come under American sanctions because of their own internal policies. But you could see the danger that it might undermine the dollar in a number of markets. There is a danger of that, the undermining of the dollar and reserve currency. And it shows that the fiscal policy and government policy in the U.S., it's not just an internal matter. It has to do with how the U.S. relates to other parts of the world. There's a lack of awareness of this in the American sort of consciousness.
There's no public debate going on right now, no serious public debate about debt and deficit spending. It's as if we can another $1 trillion stimulus package, no problem.
We have for all practical purposes adopted what's called modern monetary theory, or may have another name. And this is a theory held by people on the far left of the Democratic Party. In other words, just keep printing money until inflation takes hold, as if there's no other consequences, even if there is no inflation.
Right.
It's clear that's false.
In fact, it's the greatest tax you can put on a people is to devalue their currency. And you do it without ever passing a law. You just print more dollars and their dollars become worthless.
That's an effective tax. The Chinese creation of this digital currency and their efforts to normalize some digital currencies, they're nervous about this because they realize it might be used to subvert their own power. And so they're trying to create something that will be under their control in this regard. But you can see it as an effort, a sophisticated effort to undermine the dollar's role as the reserve currency, which has been in place since before World War II, but certainly since 1945, where it's really been normalized at that point. We are coming up now on our second break. We're going to be right back. We're the historians.
This is Mike Janity. Join me every Wednesday afternoon from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for DJ Mike Janity's Disco Dance Party on WNTN.
Welcome to our neighborhood. Our family has been doing business here since 1914. That's our tradition, and that's why we call ourselves Old Neighborhood Foods, bringing you the finest deli meats for over 100 years, all crafted from our family recipes with the finest ingredients, with no MSG, gluten, or trans fats. That's the old-fashioned way. Old Neighborhood, a family legacy of quality and taste.
Old Neighborhood quality meats and cold cuts available in the deli cases of all Demoulas Market Baskets and wholesale for restaurants, pizza shops, and delis through Costa's Provisions. Old Neighborhood Balia Hitonia, a family business owned and operated by the DeMarcus family since 1914.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. It's World History Update. We've moved from East Africa to East Asia, but before we continue looking around the world, Brendan, we have to welcome back one of our earlier historical sponsors. I think you'll remember Reformation Fitness.
Now, indeed, I do.
Now, Brendan, I know you care a lot about your health, and you're always out hiking and climbing mountains and striving to stay in shape. You've always been a healthy guy as long as I've known you. Have you considered or reconsidered joining one of these new historically themed gyms?
Indeed, I have.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad. I hope you'll throw into the mix, you know, our historical sponsor, Reformation Fitness. I know it'd be hard for a practicing Catholic, but, you know, just you can think about it. All right. Launched in Wittenberg, Saxony in 1517, Reformation Fitness began as a physical counterpart to Martin Luther's challenge to papal and other ecclesiastical or spiritual indulgences, and indeed physical indulgences, because let's just be honest, in the early 16th century, Europe was getting flabby. All right. I think we can say that. Indeed, Luther famously stated that he could never have had the strength to compose, much less post, all 95 of his theses if he had not spent at least 2 hours a day in isometric exercise and high-impact cardio. Now, from Saxony, Reformation Fitness spread across Central and Western Europe, with particularly high concentrations of Reformed gyms arising in Switzerland, understandably enough, and Holland, while Italy, Spain, and Paris resisted the movement staunchly. The Counter-Reformation Fitness movement actually began in Provence, where it ultimately became known as the Society of the Mediterranean Diet, and from which it spread to several Oxford colleges. And speaking of Oxford, in England, Henry VIII patronized but never actually visited the six Reformation Fitness centers constructed in and around London during his reign. You can see those pictures of Henry VIII. It's pretty clear, those paintings. He wasn't going to Reformation Fitness. The centers were vigorously opposed by Sir Thomas More, although he was rumored to have visited one center secretly since he seemed to be in top physical condition at the time of his martyrdom. He was a hale and hearty heretic, was he, Sir Thomas More? Now, at Reformation Fitness, all Pilates classes feature, of course, a reformer. You know that Pilates uses a reformer? Uh-huh. And every membership comes with John Calvin's 5-point guarantee. And here it is. Even if you are totally depraved, if you unconditionally elect to join, despite your limited body tone, you will find our program irresistible and persevere to join the saints in a paradise of good health. In other words, even with limited atonement, you can have complete health at Reformation Fitness.
Reformation Fitness, success is predetermined.
Wow. You know, I think this particular historical sponsor may go down as the most inside joke that we have ever had on the historians. There is a class of people out there that are going to understand the John Calvin's 5-point guarantee, but I'm not sure that many other than
I don't think it will be a large group. But
it will be the Calvinists themselves and the religious historians among our huge listening audience.
Yes.
Reformation Fitness. I'm going to rejoin Reformation Fitness. I dropped out for a while and just was doing push-ups, but I'm going to get back on that Reformation Fitness bandwagon.
I see.
All right. Well, where are we going now, Professor McConville?
We are going to South Asia for South Asian update.
South Asian update.
We are at the 50th anniversary of the Bangladeshi War of Independence against Pakistan.
All right.
In 1971, East Pakistan, with the aid of India, broke away. It's hard for people now who are younger. They would not remember. Pakistan was divided. In other words, there was the Pakistan that we have now, and then there was a portion of Pakistan that was to the east of India. And the reason for that split was that was when the English were dividing up places in the 20th century. They put the Muslims all in one polity, even if they weren't all together. It was a completely separate Muslim population in Bangladesh, but the British joined them to Pakistan because they were all Muslims and it had all been part of what was called British India.
Yes, so this was the English imperial system, which was based on the question, I say, does anyone have a pencil?
Yes, right. Can I draw a line here?
Oh, those Brits.
So it's 1971. I remember that war quite well. It's one of the first international events that I remember well. I remember my father talking to me about it and sort of explaining what the basic issues were. The Indians played a central role in helping Bangladesh break away, and they were seen as an ally. Some people do associate that war, the 71 war, with the development of the Indian atomic program, which exploded an atomic bomb in 1974. But I actually think that the earlier conflict with China in the early 1960s is at the root of that. But there is some association. As part of the celebration, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India visited Bangladesh. This led to rioting, which killed 12 people. Why? Why, you ask?
Yeah, I ask why.
Because Modi is identified with, again, in quotes, what we call Hindu nationalism.
Right.
And the people of Bangladesh are largely Muslim. And they began to attack people in Bangladesh who were Hindu. As part of it, they see Modi as being a confrontational figure who's trying to promote Hindus at the expense of Muslims. And therefore,
yeah. Should Modi have been able to predict that his visit would provoke this kind of reaction, do you think?
I think he should have, yes. Yeah. But the people of Bangladesh, one thing I do want to note about this, of course, I'm no expert on Bangladesh or South Asia. I'm not an expert. Bangladesh has also become a manufacturing power now, primarily of inexpensive, textiles and stuff, but it's becoming more and more important. And the standard of living in Bangladesh has risen significantly in the last 15 to 20 years. That's also involved with money from abroad, a lot of it from East Asia, some of it from North America. But there is a manufacturing base in Bangladesh, and it is a country that's standard of living. It's still a lot of poverty there, but it's rising. And again, it's not as we once imagined it. But I did want to bring that to people's attention, and that the 71 war, in their celebration of that historical, the memory of it, it's led to the death of 12 people, which of course should never happen. But you understand what the issues are in terms of the Hindu-Muslim issues in South Asia, which are in it, even describing it that way is in a sense generalizing and sort of missing the subtlety of it all. I also want to call people's attention seriously to Sri Lanka again. In Sri Lanka, the Chinese have allowed a currency swap and other debt relief in Sri Lanka. Why? Because they're interested in keeping the government of Sri Lanka stable, because the government of Sri Lanka that's in now, that won the recent election, is seen as being pro-Chinese. So Sri Lanka is vital to them because their oil from the Mideast and their industrial ties in East Africa and in Ethiopia, to get any kind of thing, to get oil and industrial goods from China to Ethiopia or from Ethiopia to China, you've got to pass by that area. If Sri Lanka is hostile to China, it's a problem. Now, while that's been going on, and the Chinese lent money to Sri Lanka in the Belt and Road Initiative, as I talked about in an earlier episode, and then when Sri Lanka couldn't pay those loans, they took control of that one port on a 99-year lease, which I would point out.
That's a rather awkward number for China, isn't it?
Yeah, given the history of Hong Kong, you would think that would sort of thing would be strange, but... The other thing, though, it is a vitally strategic location. Of course, it's also, given China's rivalry with India, it has strategic value in that regard because it's near India, obviously. But in response to this, in my opinion, there's a relationship. The Chinese are basically acting to prop up the public finances of Sri Lanka. While that's been going on, several Western powers and the United Nations have now begun to make claim or assert the need for investigations in Sri Lanka in regard to the civil war in Sri Lanka that raged in the late 20th and early 21st century between the Tamil people of the north, who were related to Tamil people in India, and the Sinhalese, I believe that's how it's pronounced. I don't know the exact pronunciation, the Sinhalese people of the center and south. And of course, that was a nasty, dirty war between the Tamil Tigers, which was the main guerrilla group, and other smaller guerrilla groups of the north and the main central government. It was along ethnic lines, and there was a lot of bloodshed.
So is the idea that this investigation will somehow undermine the current regime?
I'm very suspicious about the timing of these claims. It really does look like the use of international bodies, like the UN's investigation of war crimes and the World Health Organization and other organizations, are being used in the international power struggle that involves China. That I do, you know, in one way or another, I do think it looks, I may be entirely wrong, and the history of this may be much deeper, but I am curious about the timing of these public calls for investigation into what's going on in Sri Lanka.
I'd find it outrageous. The very idea that the World Health Organization or any of these national organizations could be under the influence of China, it's an outrageous claim. Outrageous,
well,
I say.
But what I'm saying in this regard is that it seems to me that people with a vested interest in China not getting firmly established in Sri Lanka are calling for investigations of what happened
to undermine the current regime, which has the connections with China.
To China. Yes, that's what I'm saying at this point. Although what I am saying is that these international bodies, like the UN's commission that investigates war crimes and atrocities, and the World Health Organization, which should not be politicized, they are being portrayed in the press, it seems to me, as being politicized. And I'm curious whether that's the case. I may be entirely wrong, but it does. The timing of that call strikes me as being unusual.
This reminds me of the great McConville innovation in the study of history, which you brought to bear, I don't know, probably 30 years ago, which I believe you call chronology.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, chronology. But I am curious. The British are one of the powers that's, of course, they have Sri Lanka was their colony. It was a tea-growing colony, commodity-growing colony. But I'm curious about the timing of this. I also think other powers may be involved, and certainly the UN is involved. The UN is one of the agencies doing this. And that doesn't mean, incidentally, in any way saying that there weren't atrocities in that civil war. There were. I would again point out that Vice President Harris is in part of Tamil descent. I believe her mom is, although I think from India rather than from Sri Lanka, but her mom is part Tamilese. I believe that's how that's pronounced. I also wanted to point out that in the north of India, there has been calls coming from Pakistan for India and Pakistan to pull back and have peaceful relations about Kashmir. That's why when you asked before about Kashmir, why?
I like how you ask the questions of yourself.
No, right.
I like that. Go ahead.
Why? There's two or three reasons that are possible. Either, as some writers have speculated, the Chinese are pressuring Pakistan. China has a lot of influence in Pakistan. Pakistan's their ally, to pull back because they realize that this conflict with India is driving India closer to the Quad powers. In other words, it's making India look much more seriously at a full military alliance with Japan, Australia, and the United States, the so-called Quad powers, which they're part of that. They're already part of that as an intelligence thing. So it's either that pressure, or it's the Pakistanis thinking, maybe the Chinese are getting too interested in Kashmir. And I don't want that. It'll create a more complicated problem. And therefore, getting this conflict off the books, so to speak, it prevents China from intervening in the area, or makes it harder for them to intervene in the area.
Yep.
In other words, our interest may be with India in keeping China out of here, even though China is, in quotes, our ally.
It's not as if China has been friendly to Islam inside of China.
Inside, it's not at all. Or it's possible that it has to do with water resources in the area, because the three powers have had conflict over damming in along that northern border. I do want to go to one other thing, though. The Maoist insurgency in India has become more active. And it is, I think, perhaps related to those earlier farmer protests, which I mentioned in an earlier episode of South Asian Update. What's going on there is Prime Minister Modi is doing away with the regulation and rules that protected Indian farmers and allowed them to, in other words, a more closed market. And because of that, there's a lot of unrest in the parts of the Indian countryside, which, of course, this Maoist movement is an agrarian insurgency, as many Maoist movements were. And they've become much more active again in the last few months. We're coming up on our final break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Damula Supermarkets, under the trade name Market Basket, is a chain of 80 supermarkets in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Maine. Damula Supermarkets, Market Basket, more for your dollar.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. For information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com. And of course, you can access that website and find some of our old episodes, catch up on the troubles in Northern Ireland, or re-listen to some episodes. If you're feeling a little too happy and upbeat, you might want to bring yourself down a little bit. You can do a few.
One of the strange things that I've gotten out of our episode on episodes on Ireland, apart from a lot of satisfaction, I mean, as grisly as it is, as grim as it is that I always, when people always say, oh yeah, the Irish are so friendly. And then you listen to this and you can see how even a people who are conservative and easygoing, which the populations of Northern Ireland are, can get wrapped up into such a violent conflict, and that's sustained once they, and my father used to say to me, when people would say that about Irish people and Irish Americans, oh, they're, you know, Ireland is so friendly or whatever. He would say, yeah, Irish Americans, he goes, everything's fine until everyone's pointing a gun. You know? That was his.
I thought you were going to say everything's fine until it's not, which
right,
is something
until it's
I've,
not.
Heard you, I've heard you say too.
Right. Everything is fine until it's not.
He
used to say, yeah, butter would melt in their mouths and then everyone takes out their gun, you know?
Well, listen, the thing is, it's called human nature.
Yeah, I know.
And that, in the end, it just, human beings have it. It's going to come out.
Yes.
Wow. Well, we covered a lot of ground today.
Yes.
Pretty much all of Asia and a good portion of East Africa. So
we covered, I did want to go more deeply into what's happening in several of the African societies in terms of Islamic insurgency, but we'll have to cover that at a later date as I gather more, and I'm reading more East African newspapers. And so I'm learning a lot more. East African blogs as well. There's just a tremendous amount of information out there. If you're willing to go through it, you have to sift it and sort of weigh it. I mean, we are now though up to our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News. What is happening in historical news, Professor Brenna McConville?
Obituaries. My favorite thing. Robert A. Mundell has died. Do you know who he is?
No idea.
The underlying economic theorist of supply-side economics, Reaganomics. As
Mundell?
Mundell, yeah, he was a Canadian. Mundell.
Well, I'm shocked I don't know his name because, of course, I was studying supply-side economics at Baylor before I became a historian. So
he was a Canadian. He had many conflicts with Milton Friedman. He had a number of conflicts with, in other words, he wasn't part of the, he taught at Chicago for a while and then at Columbia, but he wasn't part of the fold in a sense. He wasn't on board with all of them, so to speak.
As Friedman clearly was.
As Friedman clearly was. He did work with Art Laffer, the Laffer curve.
And, right.
But he is, in many respects, he also worked on the euro and thought the euro was a good idea because it would prevent countries from devaluing their currencies, which of course, it's created other problems because they don't. He thought that their policies would become much more uniform once a uniform currency was introduced. But of course, that hasn't happened, and it's led itself to abuses that have created many serious problems.
I've ever explained to you the way the Laffer curve can be applied to the academy?
No.
This is called the Salmon's variant on the Laffer curve. The Laffer curve says that as tax rates go up, eventually you start to bring in less income for the government because higher tax rates will drive down the actual take of the government. But I applied the Salmon's variant to the Laffer curve, which says that you get more, you get smarter and smarter as you get more degrees until you get to the master's degree. And anything after the master's degree actually makes you less intelligent. That's the Salmon's variant.
In the academy, it has a tendency to narrow visions as people focus on their research and sort of it crowds out other things in their lives. That's true. I mean, it is true. Tokoi Shinada has died at an age of 107. She was a Japanese artist. I saw one of her shows at the beginning of this century in Washington, D.C., I believe. She was a calligrapher and an abstract expressionist, interested in abstract expressionism. She was a really interesting abstract artist, in my opinion. She did beautiful work in the tradition of traditional Japanese calligraphy, but also infused with influences from late 19th and early 20th century European art. And
wow, it was really, those are a strange combination, but I'm sure it could make
really
art.
Interesting use of color and really fabulous. And of course, as you know, I'm interested in calligraphy. So as we learned in our latest episode, I'm interested in calligraphy. Buddy Deppenschmidt. He was a bossa nova. He was part of the bossa nova jazz movement.
Deppenschmidt,
yeah.
Okay.
He was a jazz drummer largely. And he sort of was a person who was caught up in taking the Brazilian sound of jazz and spreading it in the early and mid 1960s.
Antonio Carlos Jobim. And
yes. And
Gilberto.
He played with Stan Getz.
Okay.
And that's where I heard it. And that's how I recognized his name when I saw the obituary. Huh. He's passed away, as many of those mid-century jazz greats are now dying out and or have already died out. I do have some good news, though.
Thank heavens.
Star Trek related news.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Star Trek. James Doonan played nearly 40 characters on Star Trek. Scotty.
Yeah.
I didn't know that before.
Doohan, isn't it?
Doohan. Yeah.
Right.
We are right around now where we are at his, what would be his 101st birthday if he was still alive. He did a lot of the voice work of different characters. He was Sargon. And remember when they go to the planet? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, go ahead.
Listen, he was M5, the computer on the M5. That was such a classic episode where the genius guy.
I didn't know this.
Yeah. He was the Melkatonians, the one who sent out that buoy with the voice.
Right.
He was that voice. He was the oracle of the people in the I Touch the Sky. He did all those voices.
That's amazing. Well, of course, he was Canadian. He didn't have a Scots accent,
right,
naturally, although he was of Scots descent. And you know, he was a D-Day veteran. He actually, I forget whichever beach the Canadians stormed.
He was shot like 8 times or some enormous amount of times.
Yeah.
And I think they repaired him and he went back into combat. I mean, it was almost like a Star Trek episode.
It's like the $6 million Scott.
He was Trelane's father in that episode with Trelane, the boy, like who's the boy.
Now that you say this, I can hear the similar timbre of those voices, you know, come on Trelane, you know, I mean,
right.
Yeah.
He did 40 of those voices. And he said, that's one of the reasons why I was able to stay employed.
That's
can do
amazing
voices and voiceovers. It's really fantastic. He really did some incredible, some of that stuff went like Sargon. I would never have taken that to be Scotty's voice.
That's
great. I know Sargon.
I love him.
Voice.
He's one of my favorite characters.
Right. This is a piece which I've been wanting to talk about on one of the, and I sort of mentioned in passing, but the rewilding movement, which we've talked about in the show repeatedly, rewilding in Ireland, people are starting to talk about that. So we do get a little Ireland, but also in England, they're introducing beaver. There's some discussion of reintroducing both lynx and wolves to the Scottish Highlands. And people have even toyed with that idea in Ireland. Of course, Ireland never had beavers, strangely enough, but they did have wolves up until the 18th century, maybe even the early 19th century. It's unclear, probably the 18th century. And they did have bears, Irish bears.
Wow.
Ireland just seems too small for that. But, you know, bears, it just seems like, okay, Ireland, how can you have bears?
I can tell you, if they reintroduce the lynx and the wolf, they're going to be some happy lynxes and wolves because there is some juicy lambs running all over Scotland.
One of the interesting things about this is it's the sheep farmers and the agricultural interests who are saying, are you out of your minds? I mean,
exactly.
You introduce a lynx or wolves,
right,
wolves here, they're going to eat everything in sight. And of course, the problem with
it's like introducing you to a bagel, a garlic bagel.
Right. Right. There's going to be some garlic bagel eating if you do that or dark chocolate. It's another thing.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about that is the efforts to do that, of course, don't have it. There are deer in both places and that would provide a prey base. But it is amazing how different that landscape is. I mean, Ireland was 90% wooded.
So was Scotland, I believe.
Right. And the thing about it is, of course, there's very little. There's only, I think, 3% of Ireland has natural woodland on it. Mm-hmm. And there's some interest in sort of trying to restore that. One of the things that is interesting is that both Ireland and Scotland still have their salmon run. They still have, you know, other fish that run from the sea. So there is that element of it as well. But I do think this rewilding thing, I'm fascinated by it because it suggests also about how population have come off the land and moved into urban areas and coastal areas. Yeah. How do we deal with that? And how do we make complete the countryside? Do we leave it as it is, or do we try to recreate the countryside that had existed in the past?
Yeah, Brendan, New England has been rewilded. I mean, 150 years ago, it looked like a Scotland. I mean, there were no trees because it was all farmland.
In the 18th century, east of the Connecticut River, it looked like that.
Yep.
And when you drive along Route 128 or Route 95, when you're in New England or up near Boston, and you see these stone walls out in the forest, those fields were cleared. What they are fields that had been completely cleared.
I remember when I figured that out back in the 80s when I was hunting and fishing in various woods, and I kept running up on these stone walls, and I finally realized these were farms.
Right.
This is all second growth forest.
What's interesting about New England is that except for cougars, it's effectively been completely rewilded, except for cougars and salmon. Those are the two things that are missing.
Yep.
Because we have coyotes, but they behave like wolves in some respects, and they have wolf genes in them. And we also have bobcats. We have, which are now here in Dara in Boston. We have large number of deer. We have all the different fish, you know, except, as I said, the fish that need the rivers to be undammed to run.
Bears, moose, the whole
There's
thing.
Bears near Boston. There are bears very near Boston. I mean, Boston doesn't have bears, but the suburbs of Boston have bears, big bears too. Bears scare me. I'm pro many wild animals, but not bears.
Yeah, I almost walked into one in New York last year when I was.
Yeah, you told me that. That is strange. I did want to briefly raise this issue of the issue of where we are with news, its control, what's going on. The Los Angeles Times and other, you know, news companies are being sold again, often at losses. We have a kind of collapse of the print culture in terms of the daily print culture. It is really weakened. And I do think we're going to a point where it's not going to be viable. And what's going to happen is it's either going to disappear, or more likely, you're going to get what I call the Washington Post model. Somebody like Jeff Bezos buys your newspaper and begins to impose his view of what things should be. That's what's going on with the Washington Post. I don't think it is not the newspaper it once was in terms of objective journalism. It no longer reports news. Everything is an opinion. That's the same with the New York Times. Yep. It's opinion driven, not news driven. There's a role for opinion in newspapers on the opinion page,
yep.
But that you can't cover the news that way.
Oh, that ideal is dead. I'm sorry to say it is, but it is.
One other thing I did want to point out, we're coming up on the end of the show. There's an election in Greenland. Which, of course, Greenland has not been covered by the show, listeners.
Oh, my goodness.
Greenland.
Yes.
Why is this important? Why is it making the news? This is from the BBC.
Because it's something to do with Denmark.
Well, Greenland is sort of part of Denmark, although it has autonomous internal local control.
Right.
It has to do with the fact that Greenland, particularly now that warming temperatures, there's more exposed land, Greenland is a source of rare earth metals, which are key to the entire computer, electronics, battery. Yep. Most of the rare earth minerals we have now are in China. You know, that's where they come from. They come from mines in China. Even though rare earth minerals are actually not that rare. They're around, but they're hard to mine.
All right.
But the Chinese threaten people with cutting them off, including the United States, like cutting off the electronics industry. And this has set off a scramble to find other sources of rare earth minerals, which, of course, the Chinese were foolish to do that. And one of the places where they're on the surface and can be mined is in Greenland. And so this election has to do with if one party wins, they're going to encourage that mining or, you know, allow the mining, and another party doesn't want it. Greenland's population is small. It's, you know, I think you're talking about 60,000 people, but there is a conflict over that. And it's become a major thing in Greenland, and Greenland has become seen as being strategically. This is when people laugh when President Trump offered to buy Greenland from Denmark, but that was part of what he was talking about, was that there was going to be opportunity for mining there. We are up on the end of the show. We will be back soon. We're the historians.
Thank you.